don't know where you are, but where I am, it's awfully cold. So I hope this evening finds you warm. This the 5th of January 2006. Good evening, it's me, it's Bedtime Story Podcast. Roses, Rhododendron by Alice Adams. One dark and rainy Boston spring of many years ago, I spent all my after-school and evening hours in the living room of our antique, crammed Cedar Street flat, writing down what the Ouija board said to my mother. My father, a spoiled and rowdy Irishman, a sometime engineer, had run off to New Orleans with a girl, and my mother hoped to learn from the board if he would come back. Then, one night in May, during a crashing black thunderstorm, my mother was both afraid and much in awe of such storms, the board told her to move down south to North Carolina, taking me and all the antiques she had been collecting for years, and to open a store in a small town down there. This is precisely what we did, and shortly thereafter, for the first time in my life, I fell permanently in love with a house, with a family of three people, and with an area of countryside. Perhaps too little attention is paid to the necessary preconditions of falling in love. I mean the state of mind or place that precedes one's first sight of the loved person, or house, or land. In my own case, I remember the dark Boston afternoons as a precondition of love. Later on, for another important time, I recognized boredom in a job. And once, the fear of growing old. In the town that she had chosen, my mother Margot, she picked out her own name, having been christened Margaret, rented a small house on a pleasant back street. It had a big, surrounding, screened-in porch where she put most of her antiques, and she put a discreet sign out in the front yard. Margot Antiques. The store was open only in the afternoons. In the mornings and on Sundays, she drove around the countryside in our ancient and spacious Buick, searching for trophies among the area's country stores and farms and barns. She is nothing if not enterprising. No one else down there had thought of doing that before. Although frequently embarrassed by her aggression, she thought nothing of making offers for furniture that was in use in a family's rooms. I often drove with her during those first few weeks. I was excited by the novelty of the landscape, the red clay banks that led up to the thick pine groves, the swollen brown creeks half hidden by flowering tangled vines. Bare, shaded yards from which rose gaunt, narrow houses. Chickens that scattered, barefoot children who stared at our approach. "Hello there, I'm Mrs. John Kilgore, Margot Kilgore, and I'm interested in buying old furniture, family portraits, silver." Margot, a big, brassily bleached blonde in a pretty flowered silk dress and high-heeled patent sandals. A hoarse and friendly voice. Me, a scrawny, pale, curious girl, about 10, in a blue linen dress with smocking across the bodice. Margot has always had a passionate belief in good clothes, no matter what. On other days, Margot would say, "I'm going to look over my so-called books. Why don't you go for a walk or something, Jane?" And I would walk along the sleepy, leafed-over streets, on the unpaved sidewalks past houses that to me were as inviting and as interesting as unread books. And I would try to imagine what went on inside, the families, their lives. The main street where the stores were interested me least. Two-story brick buildings, dry goods stores with dentists and lawyers' offices above. There was also a drugstore with round marble tables and wire-backed chairs at which wilting ladies sipped at their cokes. This was to become a favourite haunt of Margot's. I preferred the civic monuments, a pre-revolutionary episcopal chapel of yellowish cracked plaster, and several tall white statues to the Civil War date, all of them quickly overgrown with ivy or Virginia creeper. These were the early 1940s, and in the next few years the town was to change enormously. Its small textile factories would be given defence contracts, parachute silk. A Navy pre-flight school would be established at a neighbouring university town. But at that moment, it was a sleeping village, untouched. My walks were not a lonely occupation, but Margot worried that they were. And some curious reasoning led her to believe that a bicycle would help. Of course, she turned out to be right. We went to Sears, and she brought me a big new bike, big, with balloon tires, on which I began to explore the outskirts of town and the countryside. The house I fell in love with was about a mile out of town, on top of a hill. A small stone bank that was all overgrown with tangled roses led up to its yard, and pink and white roses climbed up a trellis to the roof of the front porch, the roof on which, later, Harriet and I used to sit and exchange our stores of erroneous sexual information. Harriet Farr was the daughter of the house. On one side of the house, there was what looked like a newer wing, with a bay window and a long side porch, below which the lawn sloped down to some flowering shrubs. There was a yellow rosebush, rhododendron, a plum tree, and beyond were woods, pines and oak and cedar trees. The effect was rich and careless, generous and somewhat mysterious. I was deeply stirred. As I was observing all this, from my halted bike on the dusty white hilltop, a small, plump woman, very erect, came out of the front door and went over to a flower bed below the bay window. She sat down, very stiffly. Emily, who was Harriet's mother, had some terrible, never-diagnosed trouble with her back. She generally wore a brace. She was older than Margot, with a very beautiful white hair that was badly cut, even in that butchered 1930s way. From the first, I was fascinated by Emily's obvious dissimilarity to Margot. I think I was somehow drawn to her contradiction, the shapeless body held up with so much dignity, even while she was sitting in the dirt. The lovely chopped-off hair. There were greater contradictions which I learned of later. She was a Virginia Episcopalian who always voted for Norman Thomas, a feminist who always delayed meals for her tardy husband. Emily's hair was one of the first things about the Farr family that I mentioned to Margot after we became friends. Harriet and Emily and I began to spend most of my time at that house. I don't think she's ever dyed it, I said, almost conscious of the lack of tact. Of course, Margot was defensive. I wouldn't dye mine if I thought it would be a decent colour on its own. But by that time, Margot's life was also improving. business was fairly good, and she had finally heard from my father, who began to send sizable checks from New Orleans. He had found work with an oil company. She still asked the Ouija board if she would ever see him again, but her questions were less obsessive. The second time I rode past that house, there was a girl sitting on the front porch reading a book. She was about my age. She looked up. The next time I saw her there, we both smiled. And the time after that, a Saturday morning in late June, she got up and slowly came out to the road to where I had stopped, ostensibly to look at the view, the sweep of fields, the white highway which wound down to the thick greenery bordering the creek, the fields and trees that rose in dim and distant hills. "I've got a bike exactly like that," Harriet said indifferently, as though to deny the gesture of having come out to meet me. For years, perhaps beginning then, I used to seek my opposite in friends. Inexorably following Margot, I was becoming a big blonde with some of her same troubles. Harriet was cool and dark, with long grey eyes. A girl about to be beautiful. "Do you want to come in? We've got some lemon cake that's pretty good." Inside, the house was cluttered with odd mixtures of furniture. I glimpsed a living room, where there was a shabby sofa next to a pretty antique table. We walked through a dining room that contained a decrepit mahogany table surrounded with delicate fruitwood chairs. I had a horrifying moment of imagining Margot there, with her accurate eye, making offers in her harsh Yankee voice. The walls were crowded with portraits and with 19th-century oils of bosky landscapes. Books overflowed from rows of shelves along the walls. I would have moved in at once. We took our lemon cake back to the front porch and ate it there, overlooking that view. I can remember its taste vividly. It was light and tart and sweet and a beautiful lemon colour. With it, we drank cold milk, and then we had seconds and more milk, and we discussed what we liked to read. We were both at an age to begin reading grown-up books, and there was some minor competition between us to see who had read more of them. Harriet won easily, partly because her mother reviewed books for the local paper and had brought home Steinbeck, Thomas Wolfe, Virginia Woolf, and Elizabeth Bowen. But we also found in common an enthusiasm for certain novels about English children. Such snobbery! "It's the best cake I've ever had," I told Harriet. I had already adopted something of Margot's emphatic style. "It's very good," Harriet said judiciously. Then, quite casually, she added, "We could ride our bikes out to Laurel Hill." We soared dangerously through the winding highway. At the bridge across the creek, we stopped and turned onto a narrow, rutted dirt road that followed the creek through woods as dense and alien as a jungle would have been. Thick pines with low sweeping branches, young, leafed-out maples, peeling tall poplars, elms, brambles, green masses of honeysuckle. At times the road was impossible, and we had to get off our bikes and push them along over crevices and ruts through mud or sand. And with all that, we kept up our somewhat stilted discussion of literature. "I love Virginia Woolf." "Yes, she's very good. Amazing metaphors." I thought Harriet was an extraordinary person, more intelligent, more poised, and prettier than any girl of my age I had ever known. I felt that she could become anything at all, a writer, an actress, a foreign correspondent. I went to a lot of movies. And I was not entirely wrong, she eventually would become a sometimes published poet. We came to a small beach, near to a place where the creek widened and ran over some shallow rapids. On the other side, large grey rocks rose steeply. Among the stones grew isolated, twisted trees and huge bushes with thick green leaves. The laurel of Laurel Hill, rhododendron. Harriet and I took off our shoes and waded into the warmish water. The bottom squished under our feet, making us laugh like the children we were, despite all our literary talk. Margot was also making friends. Unlike me, she seemed to seek her own likeness, and she found a sort of kinship with a woman named Dolly Murray, a rich widow from Memphis who shared many of Margot's superstitions, fear of thunderstorms, faith in the Ouija board. About 10 years older than Margot, Dolly still dyed her hair red. She was a noisy, biased, generous woman. They drank gin and gossiped together. They met for cokes at the drugstore, and sometimes they drove to a neighbouring town to have dinner in a restaurant. In those days, still a daring thing for unescorted ladies to do. I am sure that the Farrs, outwardly a conventional family, saw me as a neglected child. I was so available for meals and overnight visits. But that is not how I experienced my life. I simply felt free. And an important thing to be said about Margot as a mother is that she never made me feel guilty for doing what I wanted to do. And of how many mothers can that be said? There must have been a moment of meeting Emily, but I have forgotten it. I remember only her gentle presence, a soft voice, and my own sense of love returned. Beautiful white hair, dark deep eyes, and a wide mouth, whose corners turned and moved to express whatever she felt, amusement, interest, boredom, pain. I have never seen such a vulnerable mouth. I amused Emily. I almost always made her smile. She must have seen me as something foreign, a violent, enthusiastic Yankee. I used forbidden words like God and damn. Very unlike the decorous young southern girl that she must have been, and Harriet almost was. She talked to me a lot. Emily explained to me things about the South that otherwise I would not have picked up. Virginians feel superior to everyone else, you know, she said in her gentle Virginian voice. Some people in my family were quite shocked when I married a man from North Carolina and came down here to live, and a Presbyterian at that. Of course, that's nowhere near as bad as a Baptist, but only Episcopalians really count. This was all said lightly, but I knew that some part of Emily agreed with the rest of the family. How about Catholics? I asked her, mainly to prolong the conversation. Harriet was at the dentist's, and Emily was sitting at her desk answering letters. I was perched on the sofa near her, and we both faced the sweeping green view. But since my father, Johnny Kilgore, was a lapsed Catholic, it was not an entirely frivolous question. Margot was a sort of Christian Scientist, her own sort. We hardly know any Catholics, Emily laughed, and then she sighed. I do sometimes still miss Virginia. You know, when we were driving up there, I can actually feel the difference as we cross the state lines. I've met a few people from South Carolina, she went on, and I understand that people down there feel the same way Virginians do. Clearly, she found this unreasonable. West Virginia? Tennessee? They don't seem southern at all. Neither do Florida and Texas, not to me. Dolly says that Mrs. Farr is a terrible snob, Margot told me inquiringly. In a way, I spoke with a new diffidence that I was trying to acquire from Harriet. Oh. Once I told Emily what I had been wanting to say since my first sight of her. I said, "Your hair is so beautiful. Why don't you let it grow?" She laughed, because she usually laughed at what I said, but at the same time she looked surprised, almost startled. I understood that what I had said was not improper, but that she was totally unused to attentions of any sort from anyone, including herself. She didn't think about her hair. In a puzzled way, she said, "Perhaps I will." Nor did Emily dress like a woman with much regard for herself. She wore practical, seersucker dresses and sensible low shoes. Because her body had so little shape, no indentations, this must have been at least partly due to the back brace, I was surprised to notice that she had pretty, shapely legs. She wore little or no makeup on her sun and weathered face. And what of Lawrence Farr, the North Carolina Presbyterian for whom Emily had left her people and her state? He was a small, precisely made man, with fine dark features. Harriet looked very much like him. A lawyer, but widely read in literature, especially the English 19th century. He had a courtly manner, and a s ah. Lost. He had a courtly manner, and sometimes a wicked tongue, melancholy eyes, and an odd, sudden, ratchety laugh. He looked 10 years younger than Emily. The actual difference was less than two. "Well," said Margot, settling into a Queen Anne chair, a new antique, on our porch one stifling hot morning. "I heard some really interesting gossip about your friends." Margot had met and admired Harriet, and Harriet liked her too. Margot made Harriet laugh, and she praised Harriet's fine brown hair. But on some instinct, I am not sure whose, the parents had not yet met. Very likely, Emily, with her southern social antenna, had somehow sensed that this meeting would be a mistake. That morning, Harriet and I were going on a picnic in the woods to the steep, rocky side of Laurel Hill, but I forced myself to listen, or half-listen, to Margot's story. "Well, it seems that some years ago, Lawrence Farr fell absolutely madly in love with a beautiful young girl. In fact, the orphaned daughter of a friend of his. Terribly romantic. Of course, she loved him too, but he felt so awful and guilty that they never did anything about it." I did not like this story much. It made me obscurely uncomfortable, and I think that at some point both Margot and I wondered why she was telling it. Was she pointing out imperfections in my chosen other family? But I asked in Harriet's indifferent voice. "He never kissed her?" "Well, maybe, I don't know. But of course everyone in town knew all about it, including Emily Farr. And with her back, poor woman," Margot added somewhat piously, but with real feeling too. I forgot the story readily at the time. For one thing, there was something unreal about anyone as old as Lawrence Farr falling in love. But looking back to Emily's face, Emily looking at Lawrence, I can see that pained watchfulness of a woman who has been hurt, and by a man who could always hurt her again. In those days, what struck me most about the Fars was their extreme courtesy to each other, something I had not seen before. Never a harsh word. Of course, I did not know then about couples who cannot afford a single harsh word. Possibly because of the element of danger, very slight, the slope was gentle. The roof over the front porch was one of the places Harriet and I liked to sit on warm summer nights when I was invited to stay over. There was a country silence, invaded at intervals by summer country sounds, the strangled croak of tree frogs from down in the glen, the crazy baying of a distant hound. There, in the heavy scent of roses, on the scratchy shingles, Harriet and I talked about sex. A girl I know told me that if you do it a lot, your hips get very wide. My cousin Duncan says it makes boys strong if they do it. It hurts women a lot, especially at first, but I knew this girl from Santa Barbara, and she said that out there they say Filipinos can do it without hurting. Coloured people do it a lot more than whites. Of course, they have all those babies, but in Boston so do Catholics. We are seized with hysteria. We laugh and laugh so that Emily hears and calls up to us, "Girls, why haven't you gone to bed?" But her voice is warm and amused. She likes having us laughing up there. And Emily liked my enthusiasm for lemon cake. She teased me about the amounts of it I could eat, and she continued to keep me supplied. She was not herself much of a cook. Their maid, a young black girl named Evelyn, did most of the cooking. Once, but only once, I saw the genteel and opaque surface of that family shattered, saw those three people suddenly in violent opposition to each other, like shards of splintered glass. But what I have forgotten is the cause, what brought about that terrible explosion. The four of us so often were seated for lunch. Emily was at what seemed to be the head of the table. At her right hand was the small silver bell that summoned Evelyn to clear or to bring a new course. Harriet and I across from each other, Lawrence across from Emily. There was always a tentativeness about Lawrence's posture. He could have been an honoured guest or a spoiled or favourite child. We were talking in an easy way. I have a vivid recollection of only words that began to career and gather momentum to go out of control. A voice is raised. Then Harriet rushes from the room. Emily's face reddens dangerously, the corners of her mouth twitch downward. And Lawrence, in an exquisitely icy voice, begins to lecture me on the virtues of reading Trollope. I am surprised to hear him pretend that nothing has happened, but I can hardly hear what he is saying. I am in shock. That sudden unleashing of violence, that exposed depth of terrible emotions, might have suggested to me that the Fars were not quite as I had imagined them, not the impeccable family in my mind. But it did not. I was simply and terribly and selfishly upset, and hugely relieved when it all seemed to have passed over. During that summer, the Ouija board had spoken only gibberish to Margot, or it answered direct questions with repeated evasions. "Will I see Johnny Kilgore again in this life?" "Yes, no, perhaps." "Honey, that means you've got no further need of the board, not right now. You've got to think everything out with your own heart and instincts," Dolly said. Margot seemed to take her advice. She resolutely put the board away, and she wrote to Johnny that she wanted a divorce. I had begun to notice that these days, on these sultry August nights, Margot and Dolly were frequently joined on their small excursions by a man named Larry, a jolly, red-faced man who was in real estate and who reminded me considerably of my father. I said as much to Margot, and was surprised at her furious reaction. They could not be more different. They're altogether opposite. Larry is a southern gentleman. You just don't pay any attention any more to anyone but those fars. A word about Margot's quite understandable jealousy of the fars, much later in my life, when I was unreasonably upset at the attachment of one of my own daughters to another family. Unreasonable because her chosen group were all talented musicians as she was. A wise friend told me that we all could use more than one set of parents. Our relations with the original set are too intense and need dissipating. But no one, certainly not silly Dolly, was around to comfort Margot with this wisdom. The summer raced on, not without dust and heat, Lawrence several times remarked in his private, ironic voice. The roses wilted on the roof and on the banks next to the road. The creek dwindled, and beside it honeysuckle leaves lay limply on the vines. For weeks there was no rain, and then, one afternoon, there came a dark, torrential thunderstorm. Harriet and I sat on the side porch and watched its violent start, the black clouds seeming to rise from the horizon, the cracking, jagged streaks of lightning, the heavy welcome rain, and later, the clean smell of leaves and grass and damp earth. Knowing that Margot would be frightened, I thought of calling her, and then remembered that she would not talk on the phone during storms. And that night, she told me, the phone rang and rang, but I didn't think it was you somehow. No. I had the craziest idea that it was Johnny. Be just like him to pick the middle of a storm for a phone call. There might not have been a storm in New Orleans. But, as it turned out, Margot was right. The next day, when I rode up to the Fars on my bike, Emily was sitting out in the grass where I had first seen her. I went and squatted beside her there. I thought she looked old and sad, and partly to cheer her I said, "You grow the most beautiful flowers I have ever seen." She sighed instead of smiling as she usually did. She said, "I seemed to have turned into a gardener. When I was a girl, I imagined that I would grow up to be a writer, a novelist, and that I would have at least 4 children. Instead, I grow flowers and write book reviews." I was not interested in children. "You never wrote a novel?" She smiled unhappily. "No. I think I was afraid that I wouldn't come up to Trollope. I married rather young, you know." And at that moment, Lawrence came out of the house, immaculate in white flannels. He greeted me and said to Emily, "My dear, I find that I have some rather late appointments in Hillsborough. You won't wait dinner if I'm a trifle late?" "Of course you would, she always did." "No, have a good time," she said, and she gave him the anxious look that I had come to recognize as the way she looked at Lawrence. Soon after that, a lot happened very fast. Margot wrote to Johnny again that she wanted a divorce, that she intended to marry Larry. I wonder if this was ever true. Johnny telephoned, not once, but several times. He told her that she was crazy, that he had a great job with some shipbuilders near San Francisco, a defense contract. He would come to get us. We would all move out there. Margot agreed we would make a new life. Of course, we never knew what happened to the girl. I was not as sad about leaving the Fars and that house, that town, those woods, as I was to be later looking back. I was excited about San Francisco, and I vaguely imagined that some day I would come back and that we would all see each other again, like parting lovers. Harriet and I promised to write each other every other day. And, for quite a while, we did write several times a week. I wrote about San Francisco, how beautiful it was, the hills and pastel houses, the sea, how I wished that she could see it. She wrote about school and friends. She described solitary bike rides to places we had been. She told me what she was reading. In high school, our correspondences became more generalized, responding perhaps to the adolescent mores of the early 1940s. We wrote about boys and parties. We even competed in making ourselves sound popular. The truth, my truth, was that I was sometimes popular, often not. I had, in fact, a stormy adolescence. And at that time, I developed what was to be a long-lasting habit. As I reviewed a situation in which I had been ill-advised or impulsive, I would reenact the whole sense in my mind with Harriet in my own role. Harriet, cool and controlled, more intelligent, prettier. Even more than I wanted to see her again, I wanted to be Harriet. Johnny and Margot fought a lot and stayed together, and gradually a sort of comradeship developed between them in our small house on Russian Hill. I went to Stanford, where I half-heartedly studied history. Harriet was at Radcliffe, studying American literature, writing poetry. We lost touch with one another. Margot, however, kept up with her old friend Dolly by means of Christmas cards and Easter notes, and Margot thus heard a remarkable piece of news about Emily Farr. "Emily, up and left Lawrence without so much as a by your leave," said Dolly, "and went to Washington, D.C. to work in the Folger Library." This news made me smile all day. I was so proud of Emily. And I imagined that Lawrence would amuse himself, that they would both be happier apart. By accident, I married well. That is to say, a man whom I still like and enjoy. Four daughters came at uncalculated intervals, and each is remarkably unlike her sisters. I named one Harriet, although she seems to have my untidy character. From time to time, over the years, I would see a poem by Harriet Farr, and I always thought it was marvellous, and I meant to write her. But I distrusted my reaction. I was, so deeply fond of Harriet, Emily, Lawrence, that house and land. And besides, what would I say? "I think your poem is marvellous." I have since learned that this is neither an inadequate nor an unwelcome thing to say to writers. Of course, the true reason for not writing was that there was too much to say. Dolly wrote to Margot that Lawrence was drinking all over the place. He was not happier without Emily. Harriet, Dolly said, was travelling a lot. She married several times and had no children. Lawrence developed emphysema and was in such bad shape that Emily quit her job and came back to take care of him. Whether because of feelings of guilt or duty or possible affection, I don't know. He died, lingeringly and miserably, and Emily too died a few years later. At least partly from exhaustion, I would imagine. Then, at last, I did write Harriet, in care of the magazine in which I had last seen a poem of hers. I wrote a clumsy, gushy letter, much too long, about shared pasts, landscapes, the creek, all that. And, as soon as I mailed it, I began mentally rewriting, seeking more elegant prose. When, for a long time, I didn't hear from Harriet, I felt worse and worse. Cumbersome, misplaced, as too often in life I had felt before. It did not occur to me that an infrequently stuffed magazine could be at fault. Months later, her letter came, from Rome, where she was then living. Alone, I gathered. She said that she was writing it at the moment of receiving mine. It was a long, emotional, and very moving letter, out of character for the Harriet that I remembered, or had invented. She said in part, "It was really strange, all that time when Lawrence was dying, and God so long, as though dying were all that he was doing. Emily, too, although we didn't know that, all that time the picture that moved me most in my mind, that moved me to tears, was not of Lawrence and Emily, but of you and me, on our bikes at the top of the hill outside the house, going somewhere. And at first I thought that that picture simply symbolized something irretrievable, the lost and irrecoverable past, as Lawrence and Emily would be lost. And I'm sure that was partly it. But they were so extremely fond of you. In fact, you were a rare area of agreement. They missed you, and they talked about you for years. It's a wonder that I wasn't jealous, and I think I wasn't only because I felt included in their affection for you. They liked me best with you. Another way to say this would be to say that we were all three a little less crazy and isolated with you around and, God knows, happier." An amazing letter, I thought. It was enough to make me take a long look at my whole life and to find some new colours there. A postscript. I showed Harriet's letter to my husband and he said, "How odd. She sounds so much like you."